Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people who bring more intelligence to bear on the challenges we're facing around the world these days than our first guest. His name is Dr. Colonel Lawrence Sellin, United States Army Reserves, having served with distinction in uniform in places like Iraq and Afghanistan for some 29 years. He has been an international businessman. He has worked as a virologist and research at Fort Detrick, the Army's biodefense facility. And he has been doing incalculably important forensic analyses and reporting at the Gateway Pundit lately.
Lawrence, it's so good to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
It's always a pleasure. Let me ask you, sir, to talk a little bit about the latest insights we've been getting into both what the Chinese biological warfare program is up to and the extent to which we here in the United States, government agencies, the Pentagon, the National Institutes of Health, have been investing in and otherwise enabling that BW program.
Yes, indeed. In fact, Frank, there were two important revelations in the past week. The first information came via Project Veritas, which obtained a leaked memorandum that was written last August by a U.S. Marine major named Joseph Murphy, and he sent this memo to the Inspector General of the U.S. Department of Defense, and it's highly revealing. Major Murphy's memorandum is based on a 2018 research grant application called Project Diffuse, Diffusing the Threat of Bat-Borne Coronaviruses, by Peter Daszak, who is head of the EcoHealth Alliance in New York City. And he submitted it to the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, DARPA. And the memorandum was also based on other documents that Major Murphy had access to, but we do not yet have access to. Now, the 2018 DARPA research grant, which actually reads like a recipe for COVID-19, has been public for months. But this is the first inside the government corroboration of what many of us have suspected all along. Now, Major Murphy was working at DARPA, and he explicitly states in this memorandum that COVID-19, quote, is an American-created recombinant bat vaccine or its precursor virus. That is, COVID-19 was made in a laboratory. Now, Major Murphy states that although Peter Daszak's DARPA grant was rejected because it included dangerous gain-of-function experiments and there was a potential for dual use as a biological weapon, the funding was continued under Anthony Fauci with experiments conducted at the Wuhan Institute of Virology in China. Now, not providing specific evidence upon which his conclusion is based, Major Murphy claimed that an incomplete precursor virus was released, presumably through a laboratory accident, in August 2019, and thereafter, again presumably, circulated and mutated within the Chinese population until reaching an epidemic-producing state in November to December 2019. Now, Major Murphy also questioned the Department of Defense's vaccine mandates, given the potential toxicity of the mRNA vaccines based on the COVID-19 spike protein. And also, he criticized the official suppression by the U.S. government concerning the use of early intervention therapeutics like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, which his analysis found efficacious for treating coronavirus infection. So this is coming from someone inside the U.S. government, and those are really blockbuster accusations.
They are indeed. Let me ask you, Lawrence, is he making these representations to the Inspector General of the Defense Department as a whistleblower, expressing concern about the lengths to which various agencies and government officials have gone to conceal this kind of information, or at least obscure it? Or is this in some other form of reporting to the IG, but providing, as you say, either way, important confirmation of what many of us have long suspected?
Well, Major Murphy is not the whistleblower in the sense that he did not release this information. We don't know how Project Veritas obtained this information, but clearly this memorandum was written by Major Murphy. And what he is saying is he's alerting his chain of command that there's a real problem here and it needs to be addressed. So I wouldn't describe him as a whistleblower in the classical sense, but he's certainly acting inside the chain of command to alert his commanders of this what he considers a serious problem.
Okay, well, let's tease out a couple of the aspects of this that are indeed serious problems. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency has been implicated in some of the funding of the Wuhan program. And you're saying that in this instance, at least, they rejected an application by Peter Daszak on the grounds that it involved highly problematic gain of function research, meaning giving transmissibility capabilities from animals to humans to a virus that otherwise wouldn't have had it. And they were doing it, if I understand what you've said here, Lawrence, properly, they were doing it in the name of pursuing a vaccine. But in order to justify having a vaccine, they had to create the virus in the first place. And the virus was COVID-19. Is that right?
Yes. Generally speaking, that's correct. In fact, DARPA has, according to my information, has funded Peter Daszak in the past, but they found that this type of experimentation was just, you know, too dangerous to be conducted. Now,
Dr. Fauci permitted that to be funded through another U.S. government taxpayer underwritten slush fund, I gather, in his agency. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. In fact, that's what Major Murphy is saying in his memorandum. Now, the intent of Daszak's DARPA proposal was to immunize bats in Chinese caves by spraying them with a vaccine based on coronaviruses that would likely jump from bats to humans, thereby preventing a pandemic. Now, this was his argument, but, you know, I find it far-fetched, in the least. What they were trying to do is that this diffuse team, which included the Batwoman at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, Zhengli Shi, they would collect a large number of bat coronaviruses from Chinese caves, test them for their ability to infect humans, and then select the most likely that would make the jump from bats to humans, you know, analyze their structures and create evolutionary maps. Now, of course, the concept of a vaccine based on an evolutionary model, given the highly unpredictable nature of bat coronavirus mutations, on the face of it, in my opinion, is scientifically preposterous. Yet, if they had stopped at that point and created a bat vaccine based on a natural bat coronavirus, the project would have failed, but at least there would not have been a COVID-19 pandemic. And this is where they went too far, and I think Major Murphy is pointing this out, is that they plan to isolate the spike protein, the component of coronaviruses that regulates infectivity. They would then genetically manipulate it to make it more infectious to humans and insert it back into a bat coronavirus backbone as the virus precursor for making the bat vaccine, which Major Murphy talks about, this virus precursor. Now, the diffuse team writes about in the application introducing human specific structures like the furin polybasic cleavage site, where this structure does not actually occur naturally and is highly indicative, in my opinion, of bioweapon development and consistent with what the Chinese are doing in their joint pathogen development and vaccine production program.
Lawrence, this is so troubling on so many different levels, but it's made worse, I guess, by what we've learned this week about Dr. Fauci, his operations more generally. Notably, there were some fireworks when he testified before Congress in the Senate this week, between him particularly and and Rand Paul. Senator Paul and Senator Marshall both got into it with him pretty forcefully. What have we learned further about the Fauci operation and its efforts to cover its tracks, among other things, when its support for this kind of gain of function research in this Wuhan Institute of Virology laboratory was detected?
Well, you're right, Frank. In fact, this is the second revelation that came this week. It came from the House Republicans, who released emails from Anthony Fauci and the NIH director, Francis Collins. Now, according to those emails that were released, by January 27, 2020, very, very early in the pandemic, Fauci knew he had funded EcoHealth Alliance and that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was a subgrantee of the EcoHealth Alliance grant, and that the EcoHealth Alliance was, in fact, not in compliance with its grant reporting, in particular, a grant that Fauci knew had gain-of-function potential on bat coronaviruses. Now, on February 1st, 2020, again, very early in the pandemic, Dr. Fauci, Dr. Collins, and at least 11 other scientists convened a conference call to discuss COVID-19. It was on that conference call that Fauci and Collins were first warned that COVID-19 may have leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology and further may have been intentionally genetically manipulated. And it was then that they decided to suppress any discussion of the laboratory origin of COVID-19, and Fauci and Collins, together with Peter Daszak and other scientists, began a series of deceptive actions involving both the White House and the National Academy of Sciences. And I wrote about this almost a year ago, and I can go into detail if you'd like to discuss that.
Well, I think the main point is that what was the impact of that information being obscured or concealed or withheld from those who were trying to figure out the nature of this disease and how best to mitigate its impact?
Well, in fact, you're right, Frank. This connects back also to what Major Murphy was saying. Now, what it did was prevent us from understanding that this was a laboratory creation and didn't come from nature. So a lot of effort in terms of research and scientific publication was directed at trying to find the animal origin of this virus. You know, it also, and Major Murphy points this out, the people in charge, like Anthony Fauci and Francis Collins, they suppressed the use of early intervention therapeutics in favor of a vaccine. And, you know, I think, and a lot of people agree with me, that, you know, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people may have died or been permanently disabled because they didn't have access to this early intervention therapeutics like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. And this was done deliberately. So they deliberately misled the entire world in terms of the origin of COVID-19, by suppressing any discussion of its origin, of its laboratory origin. And then simultaneously, they suppressed the use of therapeutics that could have helped people and made everybody wait for a vaccine. And it's turning out that this vaccine in the course of the pandemic is ineffective and causes numerous adverse events.
This strikes me, Lawrence Sellin, as a crime against humanity. And by the way, this is not just ancient history. These therapeutics are still not being made widely available at a moment when the evidence continues, it seems to me, to be growing that the vaccines are not up to the job of dealing with these mutations, Delta, Omicron, and who knows what all is next. And so it's as is true of what you've found about Fauci's continuing support for some of those involved in this training or technology transfer to China of bio-warfare relevant information, that it's ongoing, unbelievably, is this point that also ongoing are the effects of these cover-up and deflections or lies to put it baldly. No.
Well, true. And it's not only the things we just discussed, but by doing what they did, Anthony Fauci, Francis Collins, and the scientists who could be considered complicit helping the Chinese to create COVID-19, they're actually protecting the Chinese Communist Party by going along with the Chinese Communist Party narrative that this virus came from nature and did not come from a laboratory. So what they're doing is essentially rewarding the Chinese Communist Party for their culpability and allowing China to proceed in this biowarfare program. And we may be facing, another situation that we've experienced over the last 2 years.
Lawrence, we have to let you go, but just very quickly, if I could ask you about what is going on in China at the moment with respect to these lockdowns, which are clearly continuing and intensifying, it seems. That last count, I heard there were something like 65 million Chinese in various urban centers that are being, in some cases, forcibly confined to their homes. Some of them are starving, by some reports, as a result. And the question is, why are the Chinese taking such draconian steps at this point? Is it trying desperately to prevent the Olympic Games from being disrupted? Or do you think that there's perhaps some new, even more virulent strain that has now emerged there that they're contending with and moving heaven and earth to try to prevent from being further disseminated?
Well, it's not quite clear yet, Frank, because the Chinese are suppressing information coming out from Xinjiang province. But what we do know is there appears to be at least an outbreak of COVID-19, the Omicron strain. But we're also getting information about hemorrhagic fever outbreak. Now, we're talking about a much, much more dangerous type of virus. For example, it belongs to the Ebola, is a hemorrhagic fever, dengue fever. These are viruses that have lethality rates of over 70%. And there's rumors, maybe more than just rumors, of a hemorrhagic fever outbreak in China right now. And at the same time, the world is sending athletes to the Beijing Olympic Games, Winter Olympic Games, and they are potentially going to be exposed not only to coronaviruses, but also potentially to these very, very dangerous hemorrhagic fever viruses.
I take it your recommendation would be that the athletes not go to Beijing?
Yes, definitely not go. Do not participate.
Lawrence Sellin, thank you for your service to our country, both in uniform in the past and in so many other capacities, but most especially what you're doing right now, which is perhaps among your most important contributions to our security and our public health, for that matter. We appreciate it. Check it out, folks, at gatewaypundit.com. And come back to us with updates soon, if you would, Lawrence. Thank you very much for your time today. We'll talk with Susan Katz-Keating, a journalist with Just the News, about vax passports and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we're joined, I believe for the first time, by David Maxwell, the man I admire greatly and whom I wanted to have on this program long before now. He is one of our country's duty experts on North Korea. He is a retired colonel, special forces colonel at that, in the United States Army, having spent some 30 years in uniform, much of it in East Asia, in which he really developed, I think, a tremendous acumen and, well, operational experience as well in terms of our vital security interests on the Korean Peninsula and things that threaten them. And we wanted to catch up with David to talk a bit about some developments there that I think fall into that category of threatening our vital interests. These days, David is in a number of interesting positions. He's a senior fellow at the highly regarded Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He is also a fellow at the Institute of Korean American Studies and a board of directors member of a terrific outfit, the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. David, it's so good to have you with us at long last. We appreciate your work in all of these fields, as well as, of course, your service in uniform. Thank you for joining us here at Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you. you, Frank. It's great to be here. And yes, this is my first time, and I'm honored to be your guest. And I'd just like to say thank you for the kind words, but I can't consider myself an expert on this complex situation. I don't think there are any experts on North Korea and Kim Jong-un. I would consider myself a student of the problem, and it's, you know, been a career-long focus to try to understand what is happening in the Hermit Kingdom in the North.
And in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, as they say, David. In this case, I'm going to qualify you as an expert as well as a serious student of the matter. Let's talk a little bit about specifically a development that I think has caught a lot of people by surprise. Two tests, one, as I recall, in December, the other earlier this month, of hypersonic missile capabilities by North Korea. What do we know about the weapon systems, which seem to have made considerable progress in the space of these two tests?
Yes. I think the first one was actually tested in September.
Was it that long ago?
And then there was an SLBM test, and there's been about 9 tests of missiles since the Biden administration has taken over. But I think it is really, you know, this is what North Korea does. They surprise us. You know, you have to respect their technical capabilities, their ability to take technology from China and Russia and adapt it for their own use. And I think, you know, certainly they must have gotten some external help, advice and assistance. But their technicians have always proven very adept at developing these capabilities. But let me say broadly what the importance of this is. Not so much, and there's still, I think the jury is still out on the assessment of the capability, and I think our intelligence experts really have to dive deep into, you know, what is capable. And then, of course, can they produce it? Can they field it? So we shouldn't overreact to this. But in the larger picture, what we see from all their actions is that they continue to have a hostile policy towards South Korea, towards the United States, toward the international community. And the importance of this system itself is to be able to attack targets in South Korea, in Japan, and of course, where U.S. forces are located. It is a warfighting capability. And I think we have to keep that in mind, that North Korea continues this hostile policy that is focused on unification by subversion, by coercion, and ultimately by force, if it can do it, to ensure regime survival. So the importance of this is it's an indicator of North Korea's continued hostile intent that has never subsided in the last 7 decades.
That's such an important point. I think it is reflected, that sentiment, that driving purpose of the Korean regime in Pyongyang is reflected in some of the other things you mentioned, the other missile tests, including a submarine-launched ballistic missile. And again, I think this is a testament, as you've indicated, David Maxwell, to the ingenuity of the engineers in North Korea. But it does also, I have to believe, reflect some considerable help from China, presumably, maybe Russia, and possibly collaborations with others as well. Say a word, if you would, about the nature of the relationships with some of these, not only the governments, but with their military-industrial complexes. And I'm thinking, in addition to the Chinese and Russians bring to bear, also Pakistan and Iran as well.
Well, certainly there's been a lot of exchanges with Pakistan. Of course, AQCON, this nuclear network, it really contributed to North Korea's nuclear development. So there is that. But also South Korean missile technology transferred to Pakistan and to Iran. And I think the relationship between North Korea and Iran is really important. And a lot of the Iranian missile capabilities and the facilities that produce them have been built with North Korean help. And the same with Syria as well. And of course, we're grateful to the Israelis in 2007 for destroying the nuclear facility that was being built in Syria. And that was being built with North Korean help. So, and then, of course, there is the proliferation of other weapons training in other conflict areas throughout Africa and the Middle East. And of course, North Korea does that purely for a transactional reason, to gain hard currency for the regime. It is supporting the Houthis through Iran. I think the Scud missiles that we've seen, you know, fire into Saudi Arabia are probably from North Korea, or at least, you know, built by Iran with North Korean, based on North Korean design. So there's a lot of connection there. You know, North Korea is not limited to that little tiny peninsula in Northeast Asia. It has global reach, and we should consider that, you know, it's one of the four, you know, revisionist and rogue powers that we look at: China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. And it is, and the ironic thing is that North Korea is connected to all of them. And others as well.
They all are in a kind of axis, it seems to me, increasingly. But let me ask you, David, you mentioned that this hypersonic missile posed a threat to South Korea and Japan. Presumably that's because the range it's demonstrated to this point is fairly limited. Is it not reasonable to anticipate, however, that North Koreans will do what the Chinese have done, which is to put this hypersonic front end on a longer range ballistic missile in due course, and perhaps give it essentially intercontinental capability? And again, the advantage of this is not simply that it flies very fast, but theoretically it can fly in a manner that is essentially invulnerable to missile defenses, at least of the kind that we have at the moment.
Well, yes, I think you've just articulated, you know, one of the three failures of all military operations, and that's the failure to learn, the failure to adapt, and the failure to anticipate. And you've just outlined what we need to anticipate. And I think that, you know, clearly, you know, North Korea has already demonstrated the desire to have an ICBM, the Hwasong 14 and 15, which they've tested, which is assessed to be able to reach the U.S. homeland. They want that capability. So, yes, I think it's logical and smart to assume that these tests are part of a long-term program to develop you know, more capabilities. And I think that's the other thing is we look at all these tests and we first seem to assess for the messages. You know, what kind of message are they trying to send? Do they want to negotiate? They want concessions. But first and foremost, they test, I believe, to advance their programs. I mean, you have to test your systems to be able to move to the next level. So, of course, the timing can be assessed in terms of messaging that it wants to send. But really, they are advancing their military programs. And I think, again, I will harp on this, but that's a demonstration of the hostile policies that it has towards South Korea, the United States, and the international community. And, of course, North Korea's propaganda is that it is the U.S. that has the hostile policy. We don't have a hostile policy. We want to negotiate anytime, anywhere, without preconditions. We want to negotiate denuclearization. You know, we have defense plans for South Korea. But it is North Korea that really harbors the hostile policy. And we should not give North Korea a pass when they say that. Whenever they say that, we need to push back on them and in their face articulate their hostile policy and their actions that demonstrate that.
You're so right on that. And it brings me to the next topic that I wanted to cover with you, David Maxwell of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And that is that we are watching very determined effort being made at the moment by the Moon Jae-in regime in South Korea, which is nearing the end of Moon's presidency, to finish his time in office with some grand new bargain with the North Koreans that would, quote, end the war, unquote. Something that the armistice that's been in place since the mid-1950s hasn't formally done. And the idea being that this would set the stage for, you know, a full peace with the North Korean government and be one of the great legacies of Moon Jae-in. Tell us what's going on that front and where we stand as a government with respect to this idea. Is it in the offing as you see it? And what would the implications of it be?
Well, there are many implications. First and foremost, you know, wars end either halted, cessation of hostilities through an armistice, or they're ended through a peace treaty. I mean, that's how wars end. A declaration of the end of the war is not legally binding and is only symbolic. Those are the words of the Moon administration. And so we should understand that declaring an end of the war does not do anything from an international legal perspective, doesn't change anything. It doesn't reduce the threat from the North. and the existential threat the North poses to the South. So I think it's important to understand that. And the armistice has served us well since, you know, July 27th, 1953. There has not been a resumption of hostilities, and that's because of the armistice and because of the combined military force on the Korean Peninsula. The presence of U.S. forces has deterred attack. So we should understand that first and foremost. Now, it's not only President Moon that wants to declare this end of war declaration, and he wants to do it, I think, for his legacy as a peace president. But I also believe that he really thinks that by doing so is going to somehow entice Kim Jong-un to negotiate. And I think that's what I think President Moon has been, you know, looking for ways to try to start negotiations, North-South engagement, nuclear negotiations with the United States, somehow to try to bring Kim Jong-un to the table. And there are Americans who believe that. Congressman Brad Sherman, and he was introduced H.R. 3446, calling on the Biden administration to have an end of war declaration. And there are many NGOs, you know, Women Across DMZ. All of these people are believing that an end of war declaration will somehow change the calculus. What I would say to all of them and anybody who looks at this is that flies in the face of the nature of the Kim family regime, of the objectives of the regime, and of the strategy the regime is trying to execute. And it's more than just the missiles. I mean, it has the fourth largest army in the world, 1.2 million soldiers, 70% are deployed along the DMZ and south of the Pyongyang-Wonsan line. And they are postured for offensive operations. The South Korean forces that are defending the DMZ are postured for defense, not to attack the North. But it is the North's forces that are postured to attack the South. And so we should understand that, and we should have our eyes wide open. And so as we pursue this end of war declaration, what we really need to do is pursue the conditions that will lead to a peace treaty. And one of the major conditions is that North Korean military forces must be withdrawn a sufficient distance from the DMZ. And the artillery that is on the Kaesong Heights, just north of Seoul, that can range Seoul, must be removed. And that threat must be removed.
Two last questions. One is, if we were successful in removing these forces from the immediate proximity to the demilitarized zone, the DMZ, how long would it take them to reconstitute the threat that exists at the moment, would you say? And would you anticipate that a peace treaty would actually involve some kind of more general demilitarization of these forces, not just their relocation? And secondly, you've served in Korea. You know firsthand what the dangers are. And I think you properly underscored the point that the presence of our forces there has been essential to maintaining the peace, given the nature of the hostility of the North and its, you know, posture of offensive operations and so on. Would you anticipate, if not as a objective of those who are championing, certainly in the Moon regime, the knock-on effect, inevitably, of an end-of-war declaration being the removal of those U.S. forces and, well, again, creating an environment in which the North could be free to act on its hostility?
And you've just described North Korean strategy, and that's why the end-of-war declaration is so dangerous, is that it will lead to, first, the disbanding of the United Nations command, and then political factions in South Korea and the United States will say, now that the war is over, we no longer need U.S. troops on the Korean Peninsula, so let's bring them home. And of course, we know from Hwang Jong-yap, the highest-ranking defector from North Korea in 1997, when he defected, the first question we asked him was, North Korea has spent all this money and resources developing its military. Why has it not resumed hostilities to achieve its objective to unify the peninsula by force? And his answer was the presence of U.S. military forces on the peninsula. That at the time, Kim Jong-il knew that he could not win a war with South Korea if the United States provided support. And the presence of U.S. troops demonstrated strategic reassurance to South Korea and the strategic resolve that we would defend South Korea shoulder to shoulder with South Korea against the North Korean attack. And that is what has deterred North Korea. And so this end of war declaration plays into the North Korean strategy of eventually, of driving a wedge in the rock U.S. alliance, driving U.S. forces off the Korean Peninsula, and ending the nuclear umbrella, the extended deterrence over South Korea and Japan. That's North Korea's objectives. And the end of war declaration plays right into that. And it will be supported by those factions who have a naive belief in North Korea that somehow an end of war declaration will bring peace. And we know that paper and words do not trump steel. And the steel of that, those artillery pieces on the Quezon Heights. Now, you asked how long it would take to reconstitute them. Well, first of all, you know, I say that we can't have an end of war declaration or a peace agreement without removal of the frontline forces. North Korea is not going to agree to that. I think that's, and what I want people to understand is that we have to make that demand. It has to come true before we can have an agreement. But it is, I mean, I would say 99.9% that Kim Jong-un would never agree to such a demand because of his hostile intent. And so we need to call him out on that. But we need to set the conditions that if you want an end of war declaration and ultimately a peace agreement, a peace treaty, then you must ensure that North Korea's threat is reduced. And I think you're correct to say, you know, the movement repositioning is just a first step. It's really the demilitarization that is necessary because moving them north would give us a buffer of early warning that would allow us to be able to defend against an attack. It would increase our strategic warning time, which would be more stable for us. But you know, they could easily reconstitute and reposition forces, although we would observe that and see that happening. But demilitarization, demobilization would be really hard, but it is a necessary step, point out.
Thank you for this incredibly important rendering of what's going on at the moment.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. His name is Pete Hoekstra. He has a whole slew of distinctions and titles to his credit, among them as a member of Congress, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, ambassador of the United States to the Netherlands, and now as the chairman of the advisory board of our Center for Security Policy, which I'm very proud. He is an accomplished public servant, needless to say, and one of the leading lights when it comes to understanding the sorts of challenges that we're facing in this country at the moment, and we're always delighted to catch up with him. Congressman, Mr. Ambassador, Your Grace, welcome back.
Frank, it's always good to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. You've written a piece that I think couldn't be more timely and really more important about the year 2022. It appeared on the pages of the Gatestone Institute, a superb online resource, entitled Predicting 2022, China's Year of the Tiger. Tell us a little bit about what you mean by that and its implications.
Well, you know, I'm looking at a lot of different things and trying to say, you know, you get to the year end of 2021 and people say, hey, Pete, what's going to be the big issue in 2022? And, you know, I really think this whole thing with the pandemic, but it's also trade, it's intellectual theft, it's genocide. This is an issue where the American people are actually leading. It's not our politicians. It's not our business leaders because, you know, they've all been, you know, in many ways compromised by China, but it's the American people who I think are going to lead. You know, they're moving in a direction. And having spent some time in politics, I know that when the American people, the electorate, starts moving in a direction, the politicians all of a sudden, you know, they look behind them and there's nobody there. There's nobody behind our political leaders who have said we need to engage with China. You know, we can make this work. It's a huge market. They're going to be okay. The American people are recognizing that it's not going to happen. And I think in 2022, you're going to see finally, not because this is where they want to go, because like I said, I believe many of them are compromised. But this is where they're going to have to go because the American people are sick and tired of this. They suspect that China has a much larger role in this whole COVID pandemic than what our political leaders are saying. They recognize, because you know this is not even debated at this point, that China hasn't been transparent with this. They haven't participated in any international planning and organization. And then it was kind of interesting when we talk about supply chain difficulties, where the media is focusing on these 100 and 110 massive cargo vessels that are we're off Long Beach, we're off of the port of Los Angeles, and it brings to mind, it brings to the forefront of the American people that says, hey, look at all this stuff that we're getting in here from China. Why isn't this stuff being made here? Why are we putting ourselves at the feet of China? And that they can screw up our supply chain. And so, like I said, you get into the human rights violation. The American people are sensing that there's something wrong with the Chinese Communist Party. There's something wrong with Xi. And these are not people that we need to be playing nice with. These are people that, the American people are believing we need to be tough on China, or they are going to eat our lunch even more than what they've eaten our lunch in the last 20 years.
What's left of our lunch?
They're going to get dessert now.
Yeah,
dinner too. You and I both know this. It's not funny, but for 20 years, they've taken advantage. And I still remember, it's one of the best votes that I ever made in Congress. I voted against permanent normal trade relations for China, in 2000, 2001, because, I had something in my stomach that just said, Pete, it ain't time. They're not ready. They're not going to become more like us. And by including them into, international trade, we're going to see a blossoming of freedom and, respect for human rights, respect for international law, for, international property rights and all of those types of things. So I voted no. And what we found 20 years later that, China never improved. Their ascension into the WTO, access to the world market. The only people that have benefited from this, sure, American corporations who move thousands of jobs into China. Same thing.
I guess millions.
Millions of jobs into China. And though they've, sure, corporate America's benefited, but the average American person has not benefited. We've been taken advantage of. So.
And Pete, I think it's fair to say that even corporations that have benefited, probably have not benefited in the way they intended. They thought that they'd be able to move into that huge market and they'd be able to, essentially have the opportunity to sell whatever, $1 billion, $100 million toothbrushes or whatever to the Chinese. And it generally hasn't worked out that way. They've oftentimes found that they've had their seed corn technology stolen or forcibly transferred from them to the Chinese, and now they have competitors in China, and it's the Chinese that are selling the toothbrushes, not American companies. But to your point, and I commend you for that, quite prudent vote, you didn't have a lot of company, as I recall, on that, because the Chinese had persuaded the government of the United States and many of your colleagues in Congress that no, engagement's going to be really good, and we're going to make them more like us. It's now been observed, Pete, 20 years on, that we've become more like them in a lot of ways, and are becoming more so by the day. And back to your point in the Gatestone piece, of course, a big driver in public sentiment is the Chinese Communist Party virus. And the fact that it's impacted virtually everybody in this country, either directly with, deaths in the family or great sickness of some kind or another and all of the costs associated with it, or, difficulties with their employers or, their customers or, their socializing with their families and others. I mean, everybody has felt the impact of this. And I think most of us are furious about it and would like to have some kind of punitive action taken against the Chinese for this reason alone.
Yeah, and absolutely, because They're furious with the American government. Our intelligence community, their response and analysis of this pandemic is, we don't know where it came from. And this is, you know, this is not me making it up. This is, you know, their report, the 90-day report that was requested by Biden.
The Central Intelligence Agency.
Yes. And they said, and it was supposed to be a whole of government effort. And they said, you know, we don't know where this came from. It might have come from a lab or it might have developed naturally, but we kind of still think it developed naturally. And, you know, and then they go on and say, we don't think the Chinese had any foreknowledge. And then they go on to defend the Chinese and say, you know, the reason the Chinese haven't cooperated in any of these international efforts and why they haven't allowed people into China is because they don't know where an investigation is going to lead. And the international community hasn't treated them very nicely. And it's like, excuse me, this is what we spend $80 billion on. And then I think, you know, the recent disclosures, Project Veritas, the documents that they've exposed, the documents that came from the House, I think, Judiciary Committee or the Oversight Committee.
I think it was. Yeah, okay,
released by the Republicans, the minority in the last couple of days, saying further undercutting Dr. Fauci, okay?
We talked with his Lawrence Sellin about that earlier in the show, and it's stunning now how clear his culpability is, manufacturing this disease and lying about it repeatedly. In particular, Pete, at a moment when, as Lawrence Sellin made clear, it could have made a very considerable difference in how we address the problem and
Absolutely.
The loss of life that flowed from not addressing it as well as we could have.
And I would go on, and I'm working on a project on this that says, you know, when they, you know, Fauci, the Lancet, Drazik, they not only, you know, didn't respond quickly enough to the pandemic, which you're absolutely right. In America, we've lost we're over 800,000 lives now. If they'd responded quickly in terms of knowing that it was a pandemic, we could have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. The other thing that they did is they undercut the treatments that should have been the therapies that should have been given immediately when people started getting symptoms. They undercut those therapies. And I remember talking to my doctor. I was in the Netherlands at the time and saying, my personal doctor, and saying, hey, can you prescribe me some of these medications or have them sent to the Netherlands in case I get sick? Because here in the Netherlands, none of these things are available. And he said, Pete, I can't. My the governor in Michigan has prohibited the prescribing of these drugs for COVID. And if I prescribe them, I will lose my license. And it's kind of like, well, you know, what does Governor Whitmer know about these things? And, you know, and I've never heard of that ever happening. But, you know, it's because Fauci and others were spreading this. And, you know, again, a year later, 2 years later, we're finding out that this stuff really makes a difference and would have worked.
Absolutely. And, you know, Pete, unfortunately, what's going on here, as I said to Lawrence, is that's still a problem. We're watching people struggling with Omicron, struggling with Delta, variants of this pandemic, and they're still not getting access to therapies, even at a moment when clearly the vaccines are not going to, you know, spare them this disease or the ravages of it. So, Pete, let me just turn to something else that you've pointed out in your piece, making clear that the American people have had enough of this and that it's now beginning to be impressed upon their elected representatives as well. And that is in connection with the genocide that the Chinese Communist Party has been perpetrating against Uyghur Muslims and other ethnic minorities in Western China. The House of Representatives, your old chamber, basically unanimously voted to effect penalties for what was being done. And the Senate went along with it, I think specifically with respect to the slave labor that is associated with this horrible repression of such folks. To the extent, as an old politician, that this is an indicator of where even corrupt politicians may now be headed, what do you make of it? And what should be sort of the next step in this regard, as you see it?
Yeah, well, what you'd like to do is you'd like to refer to those that represent us in Congress as America's leader. In regards to China, that's not what they've been doing. I think they've understood the threats from China and the evil nature of this current regime for quite a time. And they haven't been open with the American people, and they haven't been open in confronting China. The American people have finally, turned the corner, and they're saying, this is a terrible regime. We believe that genocide is going on. We believe that, organ harvesting is going on. We've seen what they've done with the pandemic. It's time to hold the Chinese accountable. And finally, our politicians are recognizing the American people are seeing what they've been seeing, what the politicians have been seeing for quite some time, but the politicians have never asked any action. The American people now are demanding action. And that's why I'm saying 2022 is going to be the year of China, the year of the tiger, because I think the American people, the Congress heads into the midterm. What's happened, and I think the next few months, things are not going to ever improve for China. I think their role in the pandemic is going to get exposed even more. I think that China, because of their perceived weakness of this Biden administration, they're going to make difficulty somewhere in the world because they think they can get away with it, whether it is in Taiwan, whether it is in Pakistan, whether it's with Iran, North Korea. They're going to make life difficult for President Biden and for the United States. And I think it's going to force our politicians as they move into this election season to very, very much confront China. And I think China right now is emboldened. They think they can get away with things. It's going to be a rough year for China and for the U.S.
No, Pete, that's the point at which I'm afraid we're going to probably have to wrap on this particular call, but it's one that I hope will be the starting point for our next visit, because I'm very concerned, as you know, that we're at the cusp of a conflict with China or with Russia or with Iran or with, North Korea, perhaps, or some combination of all of those bad actors, and that it's something that may be upon us far faster than any of us can believe, because they seem now to be increasingly ready to go in one or the other of these theaters in which they have territorial or political or other ambitions. And the perception that they can do so with impunity, given, the corruption of our politicians. And by the way, I did want to just put out a special plug for a new book by our friend Peter Schweitzer, that is entitled Red Hand, How American Elites Get Rich Helping China Win. So this is the kind of environment in which people are likely to be, perhaps mistakenly, but nonetheless calculating they can get away with murder. We must disabuse them of that. Pete Hoekstra, you do a great job of that at the Gatestone Institute and the Center for Security Policy and elsewhere. We appreciate you so much and look forward to visiting with you often in this new year. Thank you for your time today, my friend. We'll talk with you very soon. We'll talk with the rest
great,
of you, I hope,
you.
Again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.